Good morning. My name is Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Eileen.
Do I look big enough on these screens? I always think there's going to be like lipstick on my teeth or some horrible imperfection on my face. Anyway, in keeping with what these ladies have said, my sobriety date is March 3rd, 1975. And to say I'm grateful would be a gross understatement. My home group is Life After 10 in Santa Monica. It meets at 6 p.m. every night of the week. And if you find yourself in my town, please feel free to come by. I want to thank Harlan and Zan for all the tireless work that they do for this conference. I've been here before. I've loved it every time. I'm glad to be up on the Oregon coast. I actually spend a lot of time up in Oregon and Washington. I have family up here, and I'm grateful to be here today. I haven't always lived in Los Angeles because I'm a Jew from Idaho. And for those of you who know anything about Idaho or Jews, you know how weird that is. My parents were born in the Bronx in New York, which is where you're supposed to be born if you're Jewish. And my father was in the Marine Corps. That's right. Semper Fi. And he served a tour of duty in Guadalcanal during World War II. And he came back from overseas, and he got a job reopening recruiting stations in the West. And so he got sent to Portland and Butte, Montana, and finally to Boise. And then when he got out of the service, he became a minor league baseball announcer and disc jockey. And my parents lived there for 10 years, and my brother and I were both born there. And in 55, we moved to L.A. And I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, but I'm not a valley girl, as it were. And basically, I was the star of my grammar school. I excelled at everything but physical education and interpersonal relationships. I peaked at 11 and a half, and it was pretty much downhill from there. And I grew up during the 60s, yes, which were an incredible time to grow up if you were somebody like me. And I loved everything about the 60s. There was not one thing about the 60s that I didn't love. And I was a person who just gravitated to everything the 60s had to offer. And it wasn't just the drugs and the alcohol. It was the politics of the time. It was the freedom. It was the opportunity to hang out with a bunch of freaks, because I always felt like a freak, and I found my people. And it was on for me. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we are men and women who like the effect produced by drinking. I love the effect produced by drinking. I mean, I'm not somebody who wanted to ever socially drink. I just wanted the effects of drinking. And I was a weird child. I was a self-obsessed child. I was a self-involved child. I was always wondering how I was impacting the planet and what you thought about me. And it was, you know, exhausting. And you know, and I just never felt like I fit in, and it didn't matter how much I achieved or what I did. I mean, the great paradox of my life is that I was literally born with everything you were supposed to have in order to make it. I mean, everything that society says you were supposed to have. I was born with looks and talent and brains and opportunity. I had a supportive family. My parents were married till the day my mother died. Their names were Harry and Harriet. They were a set. They were meant to be together. They were married almost 63 years when my mother died, and they were still happy. And you know, but the problem is I was also born with alcoholism. I believe I was born with alcoholism. I mean, I took to alcohol from the very moment I started to drink, which is not to say that I drank every other second. I didn't. I was 12. And when you're 12, it's kind of hard to get a source, you know. And I'm not going to lie and tell you that I used outside issues. I used drugs. And I'm not going to lie about it, you know. I mean, I used drugs. So did Dr. Bob. Anyway, we used drugs. But I'm an alcoholic through and through. But basically, you know, well, if you're trying to get a B, beat on me. I'm kind of a Ripple and Reds kind of gal. I'm a kind of tequila and Quaaludes kind of gal. I'm the kind of gal who really doesn't really want to be here, you know? And I have two speeds. I am either in the corner drooling, or I'm operating a motor vehicle. And I'm not kidding. You know, if I can crawl to the car and hoist myself up by the steering wheel and somehow get the key in the ignition, I'm driving. Because I have places to go and things to get and people to see. And, you know, so I drank and used for a total of 12 years. That's all it took. You know, the book also says that women alcoholics are sometimes gone beyond recall in a few short years, and that's certainly the case with me. You know, I was a really nice girl. And the truth of the matter is I'm still a really nice girl, but I did a lot of really not nice things. And I'm no stranger to what the big book calls pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, except I didn't know how pitiful or demoralizing my life was. You know, because by the time I was 15, 16, 17 years old, I just sort of went with it, you know. And I like to think in visual images. And I don't know how many of you have been to L.A. I don't know how many of you have been down to Venice Beach. To the boardwalk, which is, by the way, the second most popular tourist destination in the Southern California area after Disneyland. But I used to hitchhike down to Venice when I was like 15 or 16 years old because, quite frankly, the companions that I had in the valley just weren't low enough, you know what I mean? And so I would hitchhike down, which was my mode of transportation, until the Mansons pulled all that crap. You know, you could hitchhike around Los Angeles. After that, you know, no rides for me. You know, people would drive by and see the freak on the corner and roll up the windows and lock the doors, and quite frankly, I don't blame them, but I also had my own encounters with the Manson people. Never Manson, but I did meet some of the Manson people, and I think about that a lot. You know, Norm Alpie, a guy that I knew vaguely, he died right after I got sober, used to talk about seconds and inches, you know, and I had occasion to go to the California Institute for Women on an AA panel where where all the Manson girls are housed, those who are still alive. Susan Atkins is dead now, but she was there when I went, and she was actually the secretary of the inside meeting. And, you know, those girls are never getting out. It doesn't matter how long they serve or how well they do in prison. They're just never getting out. And Leslie Van Houten's father was very active in the program in Laguna Beach. But those girls are never getting out. And I think about it because, you know, they were young girls who used drugs and alcohol and fell under the spell of this crazy guy. You know, I used to hang out in a place called Box Canyon, and it's a canyon that runs between the San Fernando and Simi Valleys. It doesn't probably mean anything to you, but it's a canyon, and it runs parallel to Santa Susana Pass, which is where the Spahn Ranch was, where the Manson family lived. And I had a friend who had a boyfriend who lived in the canyon in a trailer, and she took a hike up the hill one day, and she came down, and she said, you know, there's this guy up there, and there's all these girls around him, and they do whatever he tells them to do. And it was Charlie Manson. And we used to hang out at this place, this hippie place called Fountain of the World, which was a little further up the canyon. And a lot of the Manson people used to come in there, and I would hear them talking about all the stuff that they were planning to do. And again, I just say seconds and inches, because those girls could have been me. He also used to go down to Venice Beach to recruit people. And so I'm down in Venice Beach, you know, where they sing, you know, they play, you know, they drink wine and smoke dope and sing the House of the Rising Sun, you know, and the pagodas at these picnic tables down there. And, you know, and I have to tell you, they're still doing that today. And, you know, and I go down there sometimes. Like, I had family visiting for Eugene, and, you know, they're hippies. They wanted to go down to the boardwalk. And so, you know, we went down there, and we were walking along. And, you know, a lot of people just see sort of what looks like kind of fun. But what I notice, now they have a drum circle, by the way, you know, where people sit in a circle and play drums, as, you know, you can imagine, and with varying degrees of proficiency, but everybody's pretty loaded, so nobody really cares. And I don't notice the drummers. They're of no interest to me. What I notice are the women that are on the edge of the drum circle, okay? They're a particular kind of woman. They've had way too much sun. They've had way too much to drink. They're a little too chunky to be wearing that halter top with that Indian print bedspread. And I'm talking present day. I'm not talking the 60s. And they're on the edge of the thing, and they're dancing, you know, like this. Like how we used to dance at the Beans in the 60s, you know, kind of hippie dancing. And they're dancing and dancing and dancing. And I guess it looks like they're having fun, except that I look at them and I think, they don't know where their next drink is coming from. But I'm willing to bet that they're going to do whatever they have to do to get that next drink. And they don't know where they're going to sleep tonight, maybe, but I'm willing to bet they're going to do whatever they have to do. I used to have this friend named Kawenga Begay, who died sober on the program. And Kawenga used to talk about how she would do anything for the promise of a drink. Not even a drink. The promise of a drink. And I walk further down the boardwalk, and I see some young girl, you know, and she's like rubbing up against some sleazy guy on the bench. And I just think, I know that girl, because that girl was me. You know, 15, 16 years old, you know, down there with much older men, because, you know, they could provide me with what it was that I needed. And when I was 17 years old, I got pregnant on a one-night stand with a guy I never saw again. And by the time I got around to admitting to myself that I was actually pregnant, I was 4.5 months pregnant. And even if it hadn't been 1968, and even if I could have done something about it, it was too late. And in March of 1969, I had a child, and I gave him up for adoption, and I never saw him, I never touched him, I signed the papers, and 10 days later, I was back to partying exactly the same way I was when I got pregnant, and for the first 5 months, because that's how I live my life. That's how I live my life. It was like I just, you know, I just wrote him off and went back to doing what I was doing. And it never got any better. In 1970, I came up to Washington State to live on a commune with a guy I knew hated me in Los Angeles, but I knew it would be different in Washington, and it was. It was worse. We went to live on this godforsaken farm called Tolstoy Farm outside of Spokane in Davenport, Washington. I've actually met people in the rooms who lived there. And I lasted about 2 weeks because, let me just tell you something, Jews don't camp. And, you know, my mother Harriet used to say it's not a wilderness, you know, which meant that if you forgot your underwear and you went to New York, you could go to Bloomingdale's and get some more. You know, you just couldn't get that at Tolstoy Farm. And anyway, you know, the guy left me after a week. The dog died of distemper. I ended up living with these people in Spokane. He turned out to be a child molester. I mean, I just didn't care. I just didn't care, you know. And anyway, I eventually ended up down here in Cottage Grove outside of Eugene. And then a kind-hearted person gave me the money for a plane ticket to come home. And I drank and used for a couple more years. Couple more years. And in 1974, I didn't really know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. AA was a much more anonymous organization in 1974. And Central Office in Los Angeles used to put a single card up on the television screen in the middle of the night when alcoholics were likely to come to in front of the TV. And it was just a single card. It was not a commercial. And it said, "Do you have a drinking problem?" And it gave the number of L.A. Central Office. And for some unknown reason, and we have a 24-hour Central Office in Los Angeles, and for some unknown reason, I picked up the phone, and I called. And a guy answered the phone, and he said to me, "Alcoholics Anonymous, may we help you?" And I said, "I think I drink too much." And he said, "Would you like me to have somebody call you?" And I said, "Okay." And he woke a woman up in the middle of the night, a complete and total stranger, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He woke up this woman, and she called me, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "I drink too much." And she said, "Would you like me to take you to a meeting?" And I said, "No, thank you. I'll get there myself." I came to AA like this: help me, stay as far away from me as possible, but please help me. I was not a cuddly newcomer. I was not a vision for you. I was not the one that everybody raced across the room to get to. I went to meetings in basements in Hollywood. I leaned against walls with my arms folded and glared at people and dared them to come near me. And most of them didn't. And there were a couple of really mean guys in Hollywood AA. They seemed to like me rather well. Their names were Lee Larson and Irving Neamy. They're both dead now. And I came around for about 5 months in 1974. And I never got sober. I mean, I wouldn't say that what I did was slipping. I just never got sober. And thank God for the third tradition that says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, because not everybody can come to the rooms and get sober right away. And I always love nowadays, you know, with the proliferation of treatment centers, you know, like somebody goes, oh my God, there's a drunk in the meeting. Like, hello? Like, hello? Like, the book is called Alcoholics Anonymous, not Mental Health Anonymous. Like, it's about alcoholism and alcoholics and people who drink alcohol, and sometimes they come to the meetings and, waha, they're drunk. Woo! Boy, a drunk in the meeting. In my day, people used to detox in meetings. They'd flop out in the aisles like fish, you know, and convulsions. You learn new skills, like how to shove a wallet in a person's mouth so they wouldn't bite through their tongues. I mean, that was kind of how it was. There were a few detoxes, there were some recovery houses, but there wasn't really much. And so people came and detoxed in meetings. And when the holidays rolled around in 1974, 1975, the Christmas New Year's holiday, I thought to myself, I can't think of anything really more depressing than being in AA not sober during the holidays. And so I left, and I had some vague plan to come back after the first of the year, but my sobriety date is March 3rd, so it took slightly longer than I thought it would. And, you know, I always had pretty good intentions. Like, if my mother was talking to me and invite me to dinner, I would say, oh, I'd love to come, and then I'd run into somebody, and they would say, would you like to go to Mexico? And I'd get in the car, you know, because it seemed like a great idea at the time. And I was rather inconsistent. And but I just couldn't think of anything, like, less depressing than, or less depressing than being in AA during the holidays. And I had a therapist, and I'm not here to knock therapy. Therapy has been, by the way, incredibly helpful for some issues that I've had to deal with in sobriety. It's amazing how much help you can get if you actually tell the truth to your sponsor or your therapist or somebody who's trying to help you. If you tell them the truth, they can actually give you some help. Otherwise, it's, you know. And I always had a therapist, and it wasn't about my drinking. It was about, as my sponsor calls, unraveling the fascinating mystery of me, because I am utterly fascinating. And anyway, and every therapist that I had when I was drinking was crazier than the last. And this particular guy's name was Sid, and he was blind, and we used to smoke dope and neck during my sessions. So you know that I was getting an enormous amount of help from Sid. And Sid persuaded me to go to this place called the Benneville Pines, which is a church camp in the San Bernardino Mountains, but it's not what you're thinking. It's run by the Unitarians, who are notoriously loose. They're not like your Southern Baptists. And I only agreed to go after Sid assured me that there would be a lot of liquor at the Benneville Pines. And sure enough, we got there, and they were unloading a bunch of gallons of some unknown vintage, which was my drug of choice, unknown vintage. And, or as my friend Don Norman says, you know, the kind of wine that comes in and hovers over a grape but never quite comes in for a landing, you know? Red Mountain, Red Wine, Ripple, Mad Dog 2020, Thunderbird, you know. I'm a very classy girl. Anyway, so they were doing that, and I felt secure. And anyway, I spent the entire weekend having a three-way with a couple of sex therapists from Carpinteria, California, whose names were Bert and Sally. I don't know why I remembered their names. I guess I thought I'd look them up later. And, you know, the truth is, you know, at this point in my life, I still don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just they were creepy. Anyhow, I Anyhow, I came back from that little misadventure, and on March 3rd, 1975, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, really for no other reason than the fact that I was tired. I was 24 years old, and I think I looked older than I look today, really. And I had gotten a perception of Alcoholics Anonymous that I hold to this day. I remember looking at AA and thinking it's good, it's decent, it's wholesome, it's unhip. I was so tired of being hip. You know, I used to have a friend, he'd say, you know, I was so cool, I was frozen. And I identify with that. I've spent the last 39 years thawing out. You know, it's so hard to be hip. It's so hard to be cool. You know, you can't let anything penetrate. You know, nothing can touch you. Nothing can move you. Nothing, you know, because you just got to be cool. You know, you got to be cool. And I was so tired of it. I remember sitting in a meeting a few years ago, and a guy said, until I got sober, I never experienced joy. And I started to cry. Because I thought, neither have I. Because when you're so burdened, you know, by the obsession with self, how can you ever let anything as, you know, as beautiful as joy come in? You know, you're so busy being obsessed and cool, you know, and I was so tired. And I also felt that AA was the first place that if I admitted that I wanted what you had instead of what I had, then nobody would laugh at me. That you understood that I really wanted something different in my life. And then the next day, I went to the old Radford Clubhouse, which was in North Hollywood. It's no longer on Radford, but it was then. And the man who became my first sponsor, whose name was Bob Earl, backed me up against the wall in that meeting. And he said to me, look, punk, you have a serious problem with alcohol and drugs, and you better damn well get sober. He had met me the year before. And he said to me, and if you don't get sober, I'm going to break your jaw. Now, I don't know what you would have thought. I thought he cares. You know, I'd heard you people cared. And I took his telephone number, which was a miracle, because the year before, lots of people had given me their phone numbers. I had not called one person. Never called one person. But I called Bobby, and what was even more of a miracle is after the first time I called him a second time. And why that was so miraculous is because the first time, completely unsolicited by me, he started telling me what to do. Now, I don't know what you're like, but I don't like people telling me what to do, especially if I have not asked you. I mean, they're not kidding when they say that defiance is the outstanding characteristic of the alcoholic. I didn't like people telling me what to do. But fortunately for me, Bobby and everyone who has ever helped me up to and including my sponsor, Julie C., the great white goddess, she who must be obeyed. She just called herself Julie. I call her that, you know. Who's been my sponsor for the last 32 years. Not one of those people has been the least bit interested in my opinion about the direction they're giving me. They don't seem to care at all. You know? And they say lovely things to you, like with my last relationship when I took up with him again, my sponsor said, well, you knew it was a snake when you picked it up. Thank you! I love my sponsor. She's my sponsor for many different reasons, but she's my sponsor because she's an active member of AA, an honest and forthright woman. She's smarter than me, and she's not afraid to tell me the truth. And neither has anyone else been that's been the least bit interested in helping me. Anyway, Bobby wasn't interested in any of that. And the things that he told me to do, he told me to go to 7 to 9 meetings a week, sit in the front row, be responsible for my own chair and my ashtray, thank speakers whether I thought they had anything to say or not. He told me that I should get a big book and a commitment, and he said that I had a car and that I was essentially useless, but I could drive other people to meetings. Now, I have to tell you, I didn't care for this idea because, quite frankly, I didn't like people, and I didn't like the idea of having some total stranger in my car, but again, he didn't care. He said, put him in the car, pointed in the direction of the meeting, chances are, you'll both get there. You know, if he happened to see me not sitting in the front row, he would embarrass me, he would stand up and gesture at me and make me come and sit on the floor in front of the front row, you know. I mean, I was dead meat if he came into a meeting and I wasn't in the front row. And I had no life. Which I think is a phenomenal way to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no life. None. I didn't have a job. I didn't have to go to yoga or Pilates, you know. I didn't have no life, you know. Of course, I go to yoga and Pilates now just so I can move. But, you know, otherwise I'd be like, you know. I have multiple orthopedic issues, but as I like to say, you know, I just keep striding the streets of my neighborhood because I'm the baddest mother on the block. Anyhow, As my old friend Riley used to say, as long as they make spare parts, I'll just keep on going. Anyhow, I started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first commitment in AA, of course, was shaking hands at the door of what was then the largest meeting in Los Angeles. It was called Wilshire Normandy. Do you remember Wilshire Normandy, Tom? Everybody went to Wilshire Normandy. Young, old, gay, straight, every race, every creed, every color, every economic strata. Everybody went to Wilshire Normandy on Sunday night. It was the biggest meeting in LA at that time. And I was a greeter. I was a hostile greeter. You came to Wilshire, you got greeted whether you wanted to be or not. And if you tried to go around the other way, we would intercept you at the pass. And I had a particular place that I liked to stand by the door, and I used to put my keys on the floor, and God help you if you stood there, because it was my place. And people started noticing me. They started noticing the bizarre girl at the door of Wilshire, and they started inviting me to coffee at a horrible coffee shop on Western Avenue called Piper's, where we would eat bad food and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and sit till 1 o'clock in the morning, and where I made lifelong friends. And I met a lot of great people in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of great old-timers. There seemed to be a whole school of, you know, women from the South, you know, with big hair, and, you know, they'd been married like 87 times each, and, you know, I finally figured out why I've never been married. Some of the women in AA have used up all the husbands. Anyway, honey, I know people have been married 8 and 9 times. Can't you just date? Anyhow, I met some great people. I met a woman named Bea Jorgensen who started Friendly House, which was one of the first recovery homes for women. It's still in operation, run by my friend Peggy A. But Bea started it, and she was a big Texas woman with big Texas hair, you know. And she came up to me one night, and she said, "Oh, I just love you young ones." And I thought, why? Do you eat us for breakfast? I mean, she scared the crap out of me. Anyhow, I started getting involved in AA, and, you know, there were not a lot of young people in AA, and there were not a lot of attractive young people in AA, and I was one of the more unattractive of the unattractive young people, you know. I came to AA weighing about 230, wearing a $5.99 granny dress from Zodi's, which was the low-rent Kmart of its day, a pair of flip-flops, a bad haircut that I believe I had performed on myself, spotty hygiene, and a really bad attitude, and I think I was a perfect candidate, you know what I'm saying? I really was, you know, because there was no place to go but up. And, you know, I started getting involved. And I've never not been involved. I've had different degrees of involvement as my life circumstances have changed, but I have never not gone to meetings or been involved or sponsored people or had a sponsor or worked the steps. I've always been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. The circumstances of my life the last 7 years have changed a great deal. As I told you, you know, my mother died. She died very suddenly. I was in Texas speaking at a conference in Dallas, and I got a call from my brother that my dad had taken her to the hospital, and I got home at 5:30 in the evening, and my mother had been fine the day before, was dead by 7:45 that night. And my dad, who is the prince of men, had never lived alone in his life. He had gone from his family to the Marine Corps to my mother. They had gotten married when she was 21 and he was 23. And it's now 63 years later, and there's my dad. And so, because I learned how to do what you're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and how to show up, I have spent 2 or 3 nights a week, every week, with my dad for the last 7 years. And when I get back from here on Tuesday, I'm going down to see my family in Eugene. I'm flying home on Tuesday. On Saturday, we're going to go over to a place called Ocean House, a beautiful independent senior place, and he's going to move in there for a month to see if he likes it. And it was his idea, and of course now he's conflicted. But, you know, I understand. You know, he'd be leaving the place where he lived with my mom, you know, and going to a completely different thing. And he's 92 years old, and everybody loves him. My friends all love him. He's included. You know, and I do this because it's not only the right thing to do, but because he deserves it. He's been a great dad my whole life. And I'm so lucky to still have him. I'm 63 years old, and I still have a parent. I had both of mine until I was 56. You know, and it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been convenient. But isn't that the earmark of how life is in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, you don't always do the easy thing or the convenient thing. That's what I've learned how to do. You know, you don't always want, I don't always want to pick up the phone. I'm not the most, you know, I'm just not a perky individual, you know, and, but I'm a fairly positive person, you know, and I am not a saint. I love, you know, I always listen when we read chapter 5, you know, everybody says, oh, why do you read the same stuff over and over and over? Because sometimes, you know, you may actually not be drifting off and hear what it has to say, you know, and, you know, I used to take this panel into Sybil Brand Jail, and they wouldn't allow the inmates to participate in the meeting, so the panelists had to do everything, speak, lead, read, you know, all of that, and we put on a meeting for the girls in there, and one night it was my turn to be the reader of Chapter 5, and I remember reading it very slowly and deliberately, you know, because I thought, well, if they've never heard it, maybe it'll actually have some impact if I read it slowly and deliberately instead of just racing through it. And anyway, I was reading it, and of course I came to that paragraph, you know, that follows the 12th step, which is my favorite paragraph in all of the Big Book. And I'm not somebody who can, quote the Big Book chapter and verse, but there are some things that really stick with me, and that particular paragraph does, and it says, you know, many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it, do not be discouraged. And then the greatest line in the entire Big Book, in my opinion, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. And I love that, because what it means is nobody's even come close. That's what it means. Nobody's even come close. And then it goes on to say, you know, but we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. And I think that's all any of us can do. You know, you don't get anything more than human here. You know, my old friend Serenity Sam used to say, the longer I'm sober, and he died with about 53 years, and the longer I'm sober, the more human I become. And that's really the case with me. I'm a human being. And we're not supposed to rise above that. You know, sobriety doesn't entitle us to be like the better people, the chosen people. And on the other hand, I also don't think there's any such thing as alcoholic behavior. Let me get on a soapbox for just 1 minute. Just 1 minute. There is no such thing as AIDSian behavior, cancerian behavior, leukemian behavior, and there is no such thing as alcoholic behavior. My alcoholic behavior, my alcoholism does not cause me to behave like an asshole. If I'm being one, it's because I'm being one. It's not because I have alcoholism. I don't buy it. You know, what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to do is act better than I feel sometimes. You know, and show up. And be a person among persons, you know, and not go on, you know, some crazy notion that I'm not supposed to feel the way I feel, you know, that, you know, because I have the full range of human emotions. The steps do not remove your emotions. What the steps have enabled me to do is to stay sober through every single event of my life for the last 39 years. And to behave sometimes better than I feel, and they have transformed me. When I got here, I was so negative. I was always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And in the spiritual experience in the back of the book, all they're talking about, in my opinion, is a change of attitude. I've had a change of attitude. I view the world in a different way than I did when I got here. Because I have turned my will and my life over to some power. I'm not a deist, by the way. I don't believe in the notion of one God. I'm not a deist. I'm probably a Jewish Buddhist, if I'd had to describe myself, which is like a Jew-boo, or a Judist, or something. There's definitely something going on, but I don't know what it is. And I don't necessarily refer to it as God, but if it is God, it's not an old man sitting up there judging me, for sure. You know, but I do have something to turn my will and my life over to, and I try to do that. I mean, my idea of God's will is whatever's happening, you know, and I realize that no plan is too important to cancel. There's nothing that I can't do. You know, the last time I went to speak, I mean, I don't go out of town to speak very much anymore because of my dad, and it's not because I think something's going to happen, but unfortunately, things happen. I went to Florida to speak, and I spoke. And I got a call that my father had fallen and broken his hip. So the next morning I got on a plane and I flew back to Los Angeles because that's what I was supposed to do. You know, and I got my father through the hospital. I got my father into the rehab. I got my father's room changed at the rehab when they moved a crazy man in on him in the middle of the night. You know, I got him out of the rehab. I set him up with home care. You know, I did everything that I was supposed to do, and I am equipped to do this. My job, by the way, I'm a personal assistant in the entertainment industry. And people say to me, well, what do you do? And I'm like, well, sometimes I buy dog food, and sometimes I go to the Academy Awards. And that's the truth. And I do everything in between, and I don't think that anything is, you know, too unimportant for me to take care of. You know, I believe, you know, the whole thing is about being of service. I mean, that's the thing that's really saved me. The thing that's really saved me is the notion that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have ways of being useful in our lives. You know, the people that I admire the most, or that I have admired the most in my life, are people like Mother Teresa and the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Now, you know, needless to say, I don't feel like I can compare myself to these, you know, rather living saints. But I admire what they do in terms of service. And there's another guy that I really love. His name is Ram Dass. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Ram Dass. In his previous incarnation in life, his name was Richard Alpert, and he was Timothy Leary's cohort in the LSD experiments at Harvard in the 60s. But he went to India, and he had what I believe to be a genuine spiritual experience. He met a teacher there named Neem Karoli Baba, and he came back and he wrote a book called Be Here Now. It was a big square blue book. It was called Be Here Now. And he wrote about his experiences. And I remember reading this book in college and thinking, what a scam. You know, here's some dope fiend trying to make a buck off of God, you know, because he went there and I believe he had a genuine spiritual experience. And I've gone to see him do public lectures. And what I like about him is that everything exists in Ram Dass, you know, the spiritual and the human. He had a stroke a few years ago, and he's not happy about it. You know, he doesn't look at that and think, oh, great opportunity, I had a stroke. He's pissed, you know, and, you know, because he can't talk very well, he can't walk very well, he spent some time in a wheelchair, he just doesn't like it. And he doesn't have to like it. He's had a stroke. But he came out and he gave this public lecture. He was able to talk some. And then some musicians came out to play what they call kirtan, which is Hindu spiritual music. And what you essentially do is you chant the names of God faster and faster. And it's kind of cool, I have to say. You get kind of high. And it's kind of great, you know, chanting the names of God. And what I saw after Ram Dass gave this speech and told the truth about how he felt about what was going on in his life, this look of complete ecstasy came over his face when he was chanting the names of God. And I just thought, it can all exist in the same place. It can all exist in the same place. And that's how I feel about my life. You know, that's how I feel about my life. It's so much bigger than just going to meetings. You know, it's going out into the world and taking what you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to apply it in all of your affairs. You know, at work, with your friends, with your family, you know, when you travel. I've traveled all over the world. And there's no place that I can go that I don't feel safe as long as I practice my primary purpose, which is to stay sober and carry the message. And it's not necessarily the message that you can recover from alcoholism, but carry the message of who it is that you are in the world. In January, I went with my best friend who's in the program. We went to Kenya and Tanzania on a safari. And we went there with open hearts and open minds, and there wasn't anything about that experience that we weren't prepared to just love. And we loved it. And we loved it. And we got in the car with our Tanzanian driver, and we were pleased to hear that he was glad that we were Americans, because apparently over there we're better than the Germans and the Russians. What can I say? And he was glad. And, you know, we went out on a very long drive, and finally we suggested that we come back, because we could see he was tired. We could see he was tired. And we came back, and he said, later he said, did you come back because you thought I was tired? And we said, well, we partially came back because we had seen enough, but yeah, we noticed you were tired. And we didn't feel that we needed to push you any further, even though we were paying for your services. Because we noticed. Because we do notice. Because we're polite. Because we tip. You know, I mean, you know, when we go to different cities for our international, you know, when we convene 50,000 of us, you know, as we will in Atlanta in 2015, this will be my, I don't know, seventh or eighth international that I've gone to, you know, and the people who work in the cities, because when I came to Seattle to the international here, I had a friend that I stayed with in the program who worked part-time at the Four Seasons in the restaurant, and she said that all of her coworkers remarked at how wonderful we were, how we tipped, how we were polite, how we were patient waiting for our food, you know, and it just makes me so proud because I think of who we used to be and who we've become. And it makes me so proud to be a member of an organization that can descend on a town 50,000, 55,000 strong, you know, and not trash the premises, you know, and be patient with the people who work there because, you know, sometimes it takes 45 minutes to get a hot dog in the stadium. So you stand in line and you notice the name tags of the people around you and you make a new friend, you know, and you wait. And I'm not saying that I'm like that all the time, but I'll tell you, when I'm with you, I act better than I feel, you know? I act better than I feel. I'm going to tell you a couple more brief stories, and then I'm going to stop because I don't like speakers who go over. Not warning the rest of you, I'm just saying. Like I said, I've traveled all over the world. By far, one of the most interesting experiences I had, I went to Israel for 6 weeks in 1987. I was working for a different person than I work for now, and she went over there to make a movie, and I was there. And I was having a crisis before I left, whose name I can't currently remember. So if you have one of those, don't worry, it'll pass. And my sponsor, I think, was doing a play in Arizona. So I called Bobby, who I hadn't talked to for years. He was living in Santa Fe at the time. And he said, well, of course you called me. I have to give you Nancy and Bob Wilson's number. They live in Tel Aviv. He had met them in Hawaii, but they were now living in Israel, and they were in the program. So I got there, and I called Nancy. And she said, oh, I know who you are. And I said, how do you know who I am? And she said, a month ago, somebody I didn't know in the program sent me a bunch of AA tapes, and one of them was yours. Anyway, she saved my life while I was there. You know, I know that some of you come from small towns, but in Los Angeles, we are so spoiled. There are 3,000 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area. I always love when people come to me and say, I can't find a meeting I like. So I hand them our meeting directory, which looks like a small novel, and I say, why don't you go to every single meeting in this directory and then come back and we'll talk about it. I've done the simple mathematics. If they go to every single meeting, it'll take them 7.5 years to work their way through the directory. And hopefully by then they'll find a meeting they like, and I won't have to listen to them whine for a really long time. But in Israel, at least in 87, I understand it's a little different now. I have a friend who lives there. But in 87, you took what you could get. On Wednesdays, I went to a women's stag in Jerusalem. If we were lucky, we had four people. I went out and visited some loners who lived in a settlement on the West Bank. They were from Albuquerque. They were bizarre. They had guns. They were weird. And I went to NA meetings in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv on the weekends because at that time, NA was the stronger program. And I don't care. Just give me a program. And one night, I was in the meeting and I was giving a talk. It was being translated from English into Hebrew by a native German-speaking woman. I have no idea what they heard. But about 2 years later, I get a call at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning at a time when all of you really sincere people like to get a call, but I'm usually sleeping at that hour. And a guy says, hi, it's what the hell was the guy's name? It doesn't matter. Ari, I met you in Tel Aviv. I'm in Spring Valley, New York. Do you know where there's an NA meeting? And I think, dude, I don't even know where you are. You obviously don't know that I'm 3,000 miles away and it's 3 hours earlier. I mean, you live in a country you can traverse in one day, but I said, I'm going to try and help you. So I picked up the phone and I called Central Office of Narcotics Anonymous in New York City. I hope all of you have this experience someday. Guy answers the phone. He goes, hi, I'm Joey. I'm an addict. And I think, oh, shut up. Who is, you know, because I'm not from New York, but I've got the genetics, you know, and anyway, I don't know what happened. Nancy and Bob split up. And she moved to LA, and I was able to return the favor, and then 2 years later, she went back. Oh, his name was Avner, and there was Avner, the phone call, and he was in a meeting, and he was clean, so maybe I helped. Anyway, while I was in Egypt, while I was in Israel, I went to Egypt. Why? Because you can. Probably not anymore, but you could then. And we got on a plane and flew to Egypt for two fun-filled days. Egypt is a country where you feel like you're loaded even when you're not. It's 190 degrees. You drive around in Cairo, which is like being on a funhouse ride from hell. There are no lanes. Everybody just drives wherever they want. There's, you know, camels and water buffalo and carts of Bedouins drawn by donkeys. And everybody has little fender benders, and they drive in these Fiats and these weird Russian Lada cars. And anyway, it was fantastic. I had like 2 days. I rode a camel. I went into the pyramids. I touched the Sphinx. I used to not be able to get off the floor. Now I'm like riding a camel, and I'm there. And by the end of the second day, I'm half dead. It is so frickin' hot. And I'm lying under an air conditioner in the Perfume Palace in Giza, where the big pyramids and the Sphinx are, not to be confused with the Papyrus Palace. They're two entirely different stores. And I'm laying there. I'm about 12 and a half years sober. I don't know what it is about my face. Guy I've never seen before in my life walks up to me and he says, "I can get you some hashish." I think, I'm in Egypt. Who would know? And then I think, you would. And why don't you get your butt back to that bomb shelter, even if you don't understand anything they're saying? Because the disease never sleeps. Never sleeps. I go to meetings for four reasons. Because I need them. I'm a lucky one. I've never been able to labor under the illusion that I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to meetings because I like them. I still like going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear the most astonishing things still in the rooms. I go to meetings because, as my sponsor, Julie C., the Great White Goddess, says, that's where they keep the newcomers. Not being in the habit of going to bars, I generally locate mine here. And the fourth and most compelling reason why I go to meetings is because everything that I have in my life today that's worth having is a direct result of being sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for no other reason. Not because gifts have been showered on me, but because I'm sober, I actually show up for life and do what I'm supposed to do. Okay, one last story. If you think there's going to be a time in your life when everything is going to be wrapped up in a nice, neat little package and your brains will no longer seep down your ears and down your neck, and everything will be perfect, forget it. God has a way of throwing what I like to call the celestial monkey wrench into the mix just to see if we're paying attention. And I got a whopper on July 4th of 1996. I was sitting on my couch drinking a large cup of coffee, thinking about having 4 days off of work, thinking at some point I'd get up, get the stuff for the salad that I promised to take to the barbecue later that afternoon, and my phone rang, and it was a woman, and she said, "My name is Julie Jones, and I'm a private search investigator from Seattle, Washington, and I've been asked to locate you." And I had no idea why she was calling. And she said, "Is your name Eileen Waterstone?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Does the date March 28th, 1969 mean anything to you?" And of course, it was my son. And I started to cry, and I said, "Is he in Seattle?" And she said, "Oh, no." She said, "We do this by computer." She said, "He lives in your area code. My son was living a mile and a half away from me 27 years later." A mile and a half, 27 years later. She said, "Can I give him your phone number?" I said, "No." I said, "Give me his, call him back, tell him I'm going to call him. I have a few things I need to do, like pick my stomach up off the floor, you know." Anyway, I waited about half an hour, I made some calls, and then I called him and I said, "My name is Eileen Waterstone and I understand you're looking for me." And in our first conversation, completely without knowing anything about me, he told me he had been in a rehab 2 years earlier. Needless to say, considering the details of his conception, I was not stunned, you know? And I could tell by the tone of the conversation that he wasn't currently rehabbing, shall we say. And I thought, oh, what the hell? So I said, "Hey, what an amazing coincidence." I said, "I have 21 years in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he was like, "Oh, shit. Oh, God, she knows, you know. I mean, she knows, whatever." Anyway, I went to pick him up 3 days later, except for the fact that he's 6'3", half Mexican, and a guy, we look exactly alike. I took him down to downtown to have sushi. We're both genetically disposed to sushi. He ordered some beers. I paid for him. Thought, you know, help him get in. You know, help him move in. Subject of Alcoholics Anonymous came up, and he said, oh, I'd go to a meeting anytime. AA is a great program. And I said, listen, I said, there's something you need to know about me. I said, I'm not just some casual drop-in once in a while kind of AA person. I said, I'm kind of a rabid, fanatical kind of AA person. I said, as a matter of fact, I said, you can think of me as the Empress of AA if you like. Anyhow, my son went in and out of AA for 12 years. During that time, he had a drug-induced heart attack. He went to jail. I thought he was going to die. But 7.5 years ago, he found somebody that he'd actually listened to, like I did. And he got a big book, and he got a sponsor, and he started going to meetings for real, and he started helping people. He's got 7.5 years of sobriety. And we have a relationship. You know, it's not like the relationship that a lot of you have with your kids that, you know, you raised from childhood, but we have a relationship, and we love each other. And I have a couple of grandkids, and that hasn't been an easy situation. They're with two women that he chose when he was using, and the situations have been difficult, but he's got a wonderful girlfriend in AA now. My grandson is coming to live with him full-time in August. They live, you know, just a couple of miles away from me, and I get to share in their lives. You know, and what I want to say, and then I'm going to sit down, is that the thing that I am the most grateful for is that I am the person that AA created who was on the other end of the line when he called. When he called. Because it could have been very, very different. Could have been very, very different. As I said, to say that I'm grateful is an understatement. AA has given me everything. It's given me a huge, fabulous, complicated, wonderful life. And I've been sober for every minute of the last 39 years to enjoy it. Thank you very much.